put on our PJs, build a blanket fort. Let's go inside, get cozy, comfortable. It's not a coincidence, it's a metaphor about how we come together and build a world. And when the convo ends, we break it down and begin again. Yeah. Sit down, tune in, crank it. It's time to bring your own blanket. Blanket Ninjas.
Okay, welcome listeners to a very special episode of BYO Blanket. We have on an actual celebrity, at least in my world. This is a celebrity sighting, and we get to have her on BYO Blanket. Maria, introduce our guest.
Ladies and gentlemen, and everything and anything in between, we would like to introduce you the one and only Manorma, who's zooming in from New York.
Yay!
Hi, Manorma.
Hi. Hi, everybody. That's so sweet. Okay. How you guys doing?
So good.
Yeah.
So good. How are you doing?
Doing good. It's a nice day here in New York. It's sunny. We just had two bleak days weather-wise, so the sun is kind of giving me a good vibe, ready to chat with you guys and have a little cosmic, you know, chin wag.
I like that.
Tell our listeners about a little about who you are if they don't happen to know you yet, please.
Okay, so I was raised Italian-American. How far back do we want to go? I was raised Italian-American, but I was also raised by a guru from the time that I was 13, and I trained with him. He was a brain surgeon, an ophthalmologist, and a psychiatrist, and he had a PhD in Sanskrit, as well as being a full-fledged yogi. So what I like to say is, in the style of Mr. Miyagi meets Yoda, he took me under his wing and trained me. And it was very ironic because he lived 20 minutes from my grandparents, where I was living with my mom at the time. And so it was my biggest difficulty in those days was just getting a ride from my grandfather over to the yoga center, because there was no public transport. And so my background really in yoga springs from there. And when I met my teacher, I just couldn't believe that everybody wasn't here listening to it. It struck me. Everything he said just struck me as, and that's true, and this shit's totally true, and what is going on, you know? And when I would sort of talk with people of my age group or even just other people, they were like, sometimes. You know, or sometimes they were deeply interested in it, but very rarely was it like, oh yeah, the meaning of life, you know? So kind of where it started. But then since then, of course, my teacher passed some years back, 20 something years back. And by then I had trained with him fully. And now I have a school of Sanskrit studies and luminous soul. And I teach Sanskrit, the language, but I also teach the way of the tradition. And what I mean by that is how to live alongside your practice in your daily life, which has almost become a catchphrase over the last 5 to 10 years, but how to live and integrate the teachings of Sanskrit and yoga philosophy into your life and what the value of that is. So that's really what I do. And then I told recently my guy, I said to him, you know, the truth, if somebody asks me who I am, I'm going to start telling them that I am Gandalf the Grey's slave. And I'm really their slave. That's what I do, is just clean, cook. And he laughed. He calls them esclavos. He says, oh, you are the esclava de los gatos.
Esclava, yes. We can relate.
I mean, we currently have a little puppy on our laps right now, tying us down. Maria couldn't get up if she wanted to, because he has a little wound, and so he will not leave our laps.
Yeah, and he's sad, and it's okay.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I love your background, and I like what really strikes me is the, you know, when you first listened to your guru talk, and you couldn't believe that the entire world wasn't there listening, because I can really relate to that. And what I've noticed is that Junon and I are similar in a way where we do like learning new things, whether it's science or philosophy or anything in between. And our approach to their learning is very, very different, because we're very different people. So I'm, you yeah. know, like
different between you, or do you mean different than the world?
Between both of us, yeah. So I'm very logical. I'm very analytical. It's, you know, to me, like even my dreams, if you look at my dreams, they just follow, they're very logical. And they follow a very logical pattern. That's not the case with Janan. And so when we talk about even things that we're both interested in, it's always this like, oh my God, like when I talk to you and I want to engage with you, I need to be able to relate to you because this is where you're at. You know, you're not on, and I don't want to say level as like a good or bad thing. It's just your brain doesn't necessarily think the way I do. You know, you're not interested in the very specifics of like logic and structure, whereas this, am I making sense?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Sure. But, okay. And I think also that Sanskrit, you know, what I find interesting in what you're saying and in the context of our dialogue here is that Sanskrit encapsulates both of those things. There's this highly technical, highly logical way in which the language expands. And then there's also this profound spiritual kind of, and not that they're mutually exclusive, because that's one of the things that Sanskrit and of course my guru has taught me, is that like these things can come together and then there's areas where they break apart. But I think if you leave one or the other, you're going to get into trouble. And maybe that's how you guys make like a lovely whole together, or, you know, you mutually support each other, because like the scholarship in Sanskrit and also in the traditional study of yogic philosophy and all of that, you know, there's a kind of, there's a discipline to it. There's a, you do this and then you stay with this and then keep staying with this. And there's a logic, you know, and then when you hold to this discipline, not being strict per se, but not being willy-nilly, but when you stay connected with discipline, something, there's an alchemy that happens. It's almost like when you're, I like to cook a lot. You know, there's a thing that happens where, I don't know when that moment is, but there's a moment within that pot where it goes from being separate elements to one element. And the food transforms into something, you know, with good spicing and all that kind of stuff, with, you know, and love and care, into something beautiful. And I think that with the language of Sanskrit, and Sanskrit, let's take it as kind of a larger metaphor. If we stay connected with the disciplined aspect and we also bring in the spiritual aspect, it starts to really give us a certain kind of grounding, a certain kind of, I don't know, it's like a certain strength in ourselves, because we're not leaving one part of self out. It's like all aspects are brought in. It just helps you become broader in your thinking, broader in your beyond thinking, obviously, you know. So I love that. I love that because it reminds me of that. I'm like, oh, that's a perfect match.
We're very yin and yang, that's for sure. Hey, so I just give a little bit of background. When we talk about Sanskrit, you know, I had the blessing of having that entire weekend long training with you just last weekend. Yeah, it was amazing. Though before that, you know, Sanskrit occurred to me as this thing that had a lot of A's in it, like just like a lot of asana, mama, nasana, like that, and really cool tattoo ideas, you know. So
that's funny.
it's kind of like from the outside looking in, you know, it's like looking at Latin. It's like, well, no one speaks that. It's a dead language. No one's fluid in that. We could just kind of look at it for
medical
background. So will you illuminate us and the listeners on just the depth and the breadth of what Sanskrit really is?
I mean, that's such a huge question, but let me break it into some bits that I think could be useful for the listeners and for our chat. But Sanskrit, what Sanskrit is, by the way, I have a cat, so you never know if a foot's gonna go up or a whatever. I don't know if everybody can see, but maybe they can hear only, then they don't have to worry about the foot. Okay, what is Sanskrit? Sanskrit is a lot of things, but let's start with a few definitions. So the word kr, the root kr means to do or to make, and krita is done. It's a participle. And samkrita, then you have to insert an S for various grammatical reasons. Sanskrita means some means wholly, completely, totally. So Sanskrita means completely done. Mm. It also has the connotation of refined. So you'll see in India lots of different stores that are called Sanskriti, like, you know, refined dress shops. Mm. But it means refined, honed, well done, complete. Nothing is missing. And I think that this is the concept in yoga that we're playing with, this idea. You know, whenever you're looking at practices that are talking about healing, you're also talking about the experience of wholeness. And so Sanskrit is this scholarly subject, but also this spiritual practice that allows you to have access to wholeness to the best of capacity, you know, as an embodied being. And so the more we engage that practice, the more we come to... we can say words, we can write tattoos, as you say, we can say the asana names correctly, but also, like anything, you know, the language codes the culture, or I should say it more like this, in every language is a bit of the code of the culture, mm-hmm. you know, and like, I was asking my sweetheart the other day, I said, you know, do you feel you found like your English self, your American self? And I said, because I found my Latina ma, you know, like speaking, I found her. I was like, oh my God, I got a Latina ma, you know? And so I was like, you know, and I certainly have found Sanskrit ma long ago. And so I was asking him and he looked at me and he at first took him a moment to calibrate and goes, oh yes, you know, I have found. And I think that we find parts of ourselves in language, but we also find our connection to culture. And the culture of Sanskrit is fourfold, you know, really we could say four or threefold, but it's Sanskrit is the original language of three religions and one philosophy. So Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism all originally were laid down in the Sanskrit language. And then it's the original language of yoga philosophy. For me, that's the threaded doorway where it comes from and sort of codes me back is in the aspect of yoga and or in the connection to yoga philosophy and yoga practice. And so when we engage the language, we can access these doorways. Now we could access other doorways, like I said, Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism, but that doesn't mean necessarily. And it's not against it, not for it. It's just simply the doorway for me was through yoga. And I believe that it's a very potent doorway for people because it is the original language of yoga philosophy. And therefore, how did my guru put it? He used to say, when you learn Sanskrit, you don't have to then get someone else's help for the translation. You know, you have a direct relationship with the experience.
Yes.
And I love that, you know, I think that's very cool to have your own direct relationship. So wow. Sanskrit is, as I just said, an original language of yoga. And also it is a spoken language still, and there's an attempt to revive it, but it's definitely spoken. It's not spoken like English and certainly not like Spanish as well, but it is spoken. There are people who converse and talk about everyday things and you know, Duradarshanam is television, you know, and all kinds of words, you know, and say good morning. But we do it, but the thing about the Sanskrit culture, and I think it's similar to the Spanish culture, is in the Sanskrit culture, you certainly in the yogic culture, in that aspect of the Sanskrit culture, there is an attention on reverence. I noticed that also in the Spanish speaking culture. You know, you begin with certain respectful, reverent beginnings.
It's the same in Arabic as well.
Oh, really?
Big time.
Oh, yeah. Like, so in what way? Give me a sense. Like, what would you say?
I mean, I just know like hellos and goodbyes are really, really long because it's a whole bunch of blessings and prayers. So you don't just, you could say marhaba, which just means like, hi. But like when it's someone that you're not just in passing, but you're actually saying a warm hello, it's assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi barakatuh. And that whole thing just means like hello, but it's peace be upon you. And then I can't remember what the rest of it exactly means, but it's like blessings to your family. And man, I love you so much. It's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that starts off a dialogue in a very different way than hi. And it's, I love American culture. I was raised in American culture, but it is, its sweetness is in its informality. And in other, some other cultures, this, some of the sweetness is encapsulated in that formal, reverent expression. You know, it's just, you know, different ways of addressing. But it does, you know, somebody says to you, may there be a great blessing upon your family, and may you always find, you know, this. You know, it's a little bit of a different hello than hi.
It is.
They both have their value, right? They both have their, or they all have their values in different ways. Yeah.
I think it's really interesting what you said, that, you know, the English language, the sweetness comes from its informality. And informality really strikes me because, I'm a management consultant. That's what I do for work. And a lot of times I have to work with, you know, client sites on different countries.
Oh, wow.
Which means that even though we're all speaking English, there is still this training that we have, which is like, hey, you're going to deal with people predominantly from here. Like, these are culturally what they're used to when conducting business. So when you address them, even if it's in English, it's like, use a more formal tone, even though it sounds weird to us. And you know, usually it's normal to start an email with hi, Minorma, like that's totally fine. It's professional, not in other cultures. Then yeah, you go for the super formal. So it's really, really interesting because it's, you know, I look at it from my background, like in the business world, is like, yeah, everybody's used to doing it in English, and there's still these like cultural nuances that need to be weaved in when you're dealing with international people.
That's so cool.
It's true.
That's so cool. Yeah,
to try on different parts of self too. You know, you get to see what it's like to step into that. I mean, mm-hmm. I can wear the hell out of a sari. That doesn't mean I wear a sari every day, but I do enjoy. Yeah. Wearing a sari. Sari is a traditional Indian dress, and it feel, you know, I can also wear shorts and a t-shirt. But I think that's a particularly American idea, this idea that I can do this and I can do that, you know. But anyway, raised here, that's part of what's possible.
Oh, yeah. Americans love dressing up. That's something I've known, because I'm half Arab and half white. I grew up here in America, but in an Arab, predominantly Arab community and raised Muslim. And there's definitely like two halves to that. Overseas Arabs, my cousins were like, Halloween, no, that's evil. And then here in the United States, it was like, yay, time to dress up as anything.
Right, the different cultures, sure.
Wow. Yeah, I just from learning some Sanskrit last weekend did have an upgrade in terms of my connection to the teachings of yoga. So that was really cool to experience it firsthand. And now
in the class last weekend, I was focusing with everybody on different mouth positions. And that's so fun to do, you know, because then if you can focus on those building blocks, then you can get to things like the Bhagavad Gita and mantras and, you know, which is some of the stuff everybody wants to get to. They want to get to the pronunciation of the asanas, or they want to, so they usually want to know, how do I pronounce this? How do I pronounce that? But if you understand those building blocks on the alphabet or the alphabetic level, then you can get a lot of dexterity and a lot of confidence in your pronunciation,
mm-hmm.
because you know, you just understand the building blocks. I mean,
I'm working on my N's still. If you remember, I couldn't get the four different N's different than each other. And I have oh my gosh. Well, there was nya.
Uh-huh.
And then good. There was
nya.
Nya. And then there was
position.
Na.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think a regular one, nah.
Right. We don't call it regular, fourth mouth.
You know, a regular nah.
You know, our nah, regular. And then nah.
What was the fifth one?
Ma.
Oh, yeah, ma.
Yeah, you got it. High five.
Thanks.
Good job. Good job.
Because I got a lot of N's in my name, so.
Oh, true.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier about tradition. And like we're kind of touching on it now with just like getting our tongues around the way that you say a Sanskrit word and the rigor that goes into then attaining freedom. And I'd love to talk with you about like the art of traditions in yoga.
Go ahead. What would you like to ask me?
I'm pretty young and I've only been practicing yoga 9 years. I've researched as much as I can, but I only know so much. So when it comes, to, when a person says like traditions in yoga, like what are they even speaking about?
Okay. What does somebody mean when they say traditions with an S? And what do they mean when they say the tradition? They're different.
Oh, okay.
So traditions in with an S means various schools of thought. And it means various ways that specific founders came to understand the subject of yoga. And then because of those understandings that they had, they somehow codified it in some manner, whether it be through the physical body or through Sanskrit or through pranayama or meditation or philosophical discourse. So those are, sorry, I got hair all over me, by the way, from this cat. I can't move too much. Or I don't want to give them extra love. But so those are traditions. And, you know, Mr. Iyengar, for example, he calls his yoga Iyengar yoga. It's named after his name. And he came to understand, he's obviously a very, his dexterity with the subject of yoga is born from immense in-depth practice. And therefore, his system has, you know, been extensively used by many people, and what they're studying is that's the way that into the center of things that he came to understand. So that's one tradition, and that's based on, you know, is it Raja yoga, is it Tantrika yoga, is it all these different kind of, so those traditions of yoga mean various schools of thought and styles by which someone learned. And, you know, I always tell people with my guru, if he had taught basket weaving, I would be a hell of a basket weaver because I just really enjoyed hanging out with him, you know, and I loved being with him. And it just so happened and I just noticed I felt good every time I was with him. And I don't just mean good, like, oh, I feel good. I just felt very, he had something I needed. It was wisdom, knowledge. These were things that I think are of interest to me, you know. Yeah. Some people they're not of interest to, but for me it's always been a great interest. So then you could say that I am a person who studies in his tradition, that I study underneath that I am, my way of considering yoga will be influenced by that. Does that make sense? So that's the tradition section. And then when it comes to the tradition, well, that's like this giant umbrella. And we literally use the metaphor. I don't think I have it here at where I am right now, but I have so many umbrellas in my life because that's a wink in tradition. Students give their teacher an umbrella, and the umbrella is symbolic because it means, the word for student is built off the word for umbrella in Sanskrit. So the word for umbrella is chhatra, and the word for student is chhatra or chhatra. Feminine is chhatra, masculine chhatra. And it means that they are like an umbrella for the teachings. So as they expand out, and there's so much I could say, we could just spend the whole episode on this. But I'll just say that the tradition with just a singular, not the various schools of thought, is I want to be just, you know, as my guru used to say to me, and now I can feel it, be wise, he would say, not otherwise. So
I like that.
The tradition is anything that is under the umbrella of spiritual illumination and light. And we may not in our modern world yet understand on a kind of en masse level how to access that. But, you know, we're certainly making an effort towards that more than in more in the recent times, hopefully. You know, I don't know if you know of a man named Monty Roberts. He's a horse whisperer. His name is Monty Roberts. No, I love him.
Yeah.
And I love his work. And somebody asked him, do you think that nonviolent methods for working with horses, you know, do you feel hopeful about it? He's in his 80s now. And he said, I'm 85. And if you'd asked me this 20 years ago, I would have said no. But, you know, if you ask me today, there's been a critical mass that's starting to happen. And I feel extremely hopeful. And I know that this will live on well beyond me. And I feel very, just very hopeful that this work will continue to, you know, the expression of kindness to working with horses. And there's, you can study his work if you're interested. So, but I feel similarly to him, yet I'm not 85 embodied at this point, but that I feel hopeful about the expression of the tradition through the various traditional methods or schools, you know. I feel hopeful. I think people are deeply curious, and I think by and large, most people are sincere when they engage it, you know. With proper guidance, everything is, and a good heart, everything is understood.
Mm. So true. I do really like that analogy or the story, because then it makes me think that the more specifically yoga teachers here in the West, the more they focus on, or even just attempt to, you know, touch on tradition or more the philosophy or how to embody it, like outside of a yoga class, an asana class, then, you know, there is this effort to respect and honor that tradition, honor that philosophy, and honor where it came from.
Yeah, and you know, if the more that the yoga teachers actually work to experience it, mm-hmm. the more it will naturally flow through them. So I think sometimes in the West, we try to put the cart before the horse. In other words, we want to teach it before we understand it. Mm-hmm. But I think the key is to actually, I'm getting the tail of the beautiful, your tabby, or what do you call that?
This is a big orange Maine Coon. And so our podcast is audio only. No one will see this. So listeners, our giant cat just showed his parts tail to our guest, as a cat does.
Yeah, but, you know, so that's going to be a big thing. I think if, you know, if some people listening are yoga teachers or aspiring yoga teachers, you know, first try to understand what that means for you, try to ground in that and see what value it has. And it will undoubtedly flow from there. You know, I mean, it's all felt, mm-hmm. you know, it's felt once you stand in that. There's nothing you're reaching for, you know. So it's beautiful.
It is.
Yeah, I hear a lot, for myself at least, what it would take for me to truly be in the tradition, not just like think that I am, is a lot of humility. A lot of taking my lower S self out of the equation, as being like, you know, the center of my world, and taking on the bigness that's completely beyond me. Because I can see, even in my really recent past, like yesterday, that something that gets in my way is just like the yearning to serve others is there. And then it gets tangled up in having it be all about me and like what I think and what I've learned and what I know, and that like, oh yeah, I do got it. And that just like creates a blockage to where I can't, couldn't then like receive something that's bigger than I.
So well said, you know. I think that's one of the key things that one has to practice as any kind of teacher of yoga or any kind of support in any way, you know, even if like you're supporting, like my father recently, you're aware from the class that he's been sick, and Like if I go in there and I'm like, oh, I'm going to help my father and I've totally lost the thread of whatever's really being offered to me by the universe. It's like I've missed the whole thing. You know, I may be the one with the awareness of what might be the next right step, but we're just playing on the cosmic field here, you know? And so in the same way as teachers or as practitioners, you know, it's like, you got to try to put that part in check, but not in a mean check. You know what I mean? Because if you mean check yourself, you're screwed. Basically, if you mean check yourself, you're going to battle it instead of just be like, oh, that's just treat it as a more young part. We all have it. So you're just brave enough to say it. But anybody listening and anybody here has had moments like that. But we just, one of our things, I think, as practitioners is, oh, thank you so much for revealing that. Okay. It's not where I want to live. I want to live in something deeper, you know, and we can call that ego. But the thing is, I always tell people when we talk about the ego, everybody's always like, I hope nobody smelled my ego. You know, like we're always hoping that this ego never shows up, you know, we're always like hoping that it doesn't reveal itself. And people often say to me, you know, Ma, let me know if my ego shows up. And they're always shocked when I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, you think people like it when you go, hey, by the way, your ego just showed up? Yeah, no, it's never going over.
That's so good.
I tell them, I'm not, you know, that's your job. And my guru used to say, it's our job to straighten out our own egos. And even if people listening are like, what the hell is the ego? Just that's a great place to kind of get curious and not be like, ego shaming, but not go to sleep to it either, but just to be like, what actually is my ego and where does it serve me? Where does it not? You know, because you're right, you know, to get deeper into the experience of yoga is to move, to shift a focus from an ego dialogue to a dialogue that's more humble, you know, to use the word, or, you know, filled with humility. Yeah.
I remember when I was doing my 300-hour training, and sometime at the end, there was this exercise that we had to do, which was like write your teacher statement or like your promise as a teacher. And I had a really, like, I was very confronted by this because I just felt that even after 1 year of training, that's not enough for me to just be like, oh, I'm this teacher, blah, 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 you know? So my statement, I don't remember the exact words. I just remember that my statement, my promise revolved around my studentship and how my studentship needed to come first before, you know, being up on this like podium or with the microphone in front of a class and say, here I am teaching to you students. It's no, my studentship has to come first.
That's so beautiful. I love that. I actually think that that's such a fan-frickin-tastic thing to say, you know, that if we place our studentship first and we place our own development, then the teaching, how could it go wrong? You know, and that's what sort of seems to be a bit of difficulty nowadays, that the teaching has gone in front and the studentship has gone a little bit behind. So I love that, you know, I'll be there. I'll bring my Sanskrit pom-poms. I'm the one person in bleachers.
I was reading the Gita last night, and the verse I got to was the one with, and I'm going to paraphrase, obviously, because I'm not speaking English anyway.
Sure.
that the will can be our best friend and our worst enemy. Is that it?
Oh, yes. I can't remember the verse, but I know the verse.
It's like the self or the will. I remember the translation said will. The will is the best friend and the worst enemy. And I mean, my American mind translates that as like me in this life, like I'm an awesome tool to be used in service. But if I identify with it, then I just become a tool.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all what you make of it, right? It's like, you know, what do you make of the practice, you know, and what do you make of this? Well, you know, Mary Oliver says, what will I make of this one precious life? I guess I would just adjust that and be like, what will I make of this 10,000 lives, you know, but use a little yogic spin on it. But how do you want to spend yourself? What do you want to make of that? What do you want to, you know, it's not just deep thoughts with Ma. It's like, where do you want to, I mean, I like to laugh all freaking day long. I literally crack myself up all day long, but it doesn't mean I can't be serious. And it doesn't mean, you know, I love things that are of a spiritual nature, but I also love logic. You cannot love Sanskrit and not love logic. You cannot go deeply into Sanskrit without leaving logic. That's the complex part. Mm-hmm. But you need somebody to show you where. You know, my guru was a scientist. He was a, you go up in his attic, there's literally a skeleton. I went up there one day and I was like, ah, there's a skeleton up here. I said, Guruji, there's a skeleton literally in your closet. He thought that was funny. And, you know, there's all these books on the eyeball and on, you know, the brain. He was a brain surgeon.
Wow.
He was an ophthalmologist. He was a psychiatrist. These are not things that somebody can say. You know, this is look upable. Dr. R.S. Mishra, he wrote books. He wrote these yogic texts back in the 50s that were sort of somehow linked with medicine or, you know, because of his background. And he used to say, and he talked endlessly about how yoga was going to explode in the West and it would take time. It, you know, wouldn't necessarily be in his generation, but it was coming. And, you know, he had foresight. But he also had this spiritual part that was so cultivated. And so when I met him, that really struck me because I came from a highly intellectual family. You know, my siblings are highly intellectual. And at the same time, what I loved about him was he didn't lose the juice. Somehow he kept the high intellectuality and that artistic or that juicy. And the two of them came together and it was like Shazam. And, you know, I like that in the practice. And so I like that there are practical elements, like, and then there's also like Shazam, you know, and those who like the Shazam, they need to go back and look at those practical elements. And those that love the practical elements, they can benefit from letting go of the wall of the practicality and, you know, not circumventing it, but traverse to that kind of Shazam or the, you know, the
Shazam land.
Magic. Shazam-y.
Shazam-y.
Yeah, and I think yoga, I think the tradition, just to use the umbrella image that we've given, really requires those two elements coming together. You know, I really do feel that that's a full rounded, you know, you can't leave the scholarship behind or you're just going to be like in no man's land. But at the same time, you know, only scholarship isn't the dealio, where they would say, you know, to understand yoga fully, go get your, you know, PhD in yoga.
You know, this reminds me of an episode we had a few years ago on creativity, where we talked about, you know, like, okay, great, like creativity and sometimes structures or like, you know, the logic and putting things in a box almost seem counterintuitive. And in order to have productive creativity, you need a structure. So that paradox. That's
right.
Yeah.
That's right. My mother was a sculptor. And she was also, she worked as a therapist or a social worker first and a therapist. But she always longed to get back to sculpture. And my brother has become a world-class sculptor. He took off from that concept, but art was always living in our family. Mm. And my mother, they just wouldn't let her be an artist as a kid. You know, her family was very, very strict. And so in the later years after her kids grew up and they were sort of all on their way, we were sitting in the kitchen one day and I said to her, so what do you want to be when you grow up, Slim? This was always our running joke, you know. She goes, I don't know. I really miss sculpture and art. And I said, so why don't you do it? And she goes, well, it needs anatomy. Like this was a fate worse than death, you know, anatomy. And I was like, well, it's just anatomy. And she's like, oh. But I think because her family was so strict and disciplined, she had mapped out strict as discipline. Mm-hmm. And I said, Mom, strict doesn't mean discipline. That's one way of engaging it. But you need discipline to grow in the creative aspect. So your sculptures will become free. And then I looked at her and I go, that's it, Mom, you know, because you need, you know, the discipline is the structure by which you become free. But you need that structure. So yes, that was like a revelation. After that, she did go to anatomy school. And sometime I'll show you guys the sculpture, her last sculpture. But it was much more anatomically correct. And she was able to actually express much more through that sculpture, you know, that she wanted. Yeah, it was really, really useful. But it was a big revelation to her, this concept that she could take back. You know, that take back the night, you know, when I was in college, there was this thing, take back the night, ladies, take back, you know, like, we're not going to be afraid to walk around on campus. Well, I told my mother, take back discipline on your own terms. Mm-hmm. Have it be sweet discipline. You know, don't let it be something that someone else defines for you. Let it be something that works for you. Otherwise, you miss the gift of the discipline is really the ability to stay with it until it transforms, you know. Wow. You got to stay on.
That's so good. Thank you for sharing that. In the Tao, it said it's the pot. Is it the pot or the jar or the vase? I don't know. The pot creates
some vessel.
Yeah.
The vessel. The vessel makes a shape, but it's the space inside that makes it useful. But we have to have the shape, you know, got to have the form. God.
This is why the Stoics also talk about stillness and discipline being one of the core values of Stoicism.
That's interesting. What is Stoicism? I don't even know what that is.
Stoic philosophy. It's a type of philosophy. And
I think it's Greek.
Started in what it was eventually the Roman Empire, Greece, Mesopotamia, Macedonia.
She knows a lot more about it than I'm the Taoist. I'm the Taoist yogi, and she's the Stoic yogi over here. So, we're at the end of the episode. Very unfortunately, time only goes forward. So,
Can I say one thing additional?
Yes, please. And then I was going to have you talk about your upcoming training. So, carry on, my wayward friend.
Okay, so I wanted to say something about the Gita. So you mentioned a verse, but I was thinking of this other verse. After that, and it's this verse that says, it says, for example, yat karoshi yarashnasi, yat juhoshi dadasi yat, yat tapasyasi kaunteya, tat kurushva madarpanam. And it's chanted so lovely. It's I'll chant it for you after, but it's basically like a recipe. And for me, the Bhagavad Gita are recipes. Mm. They're recipes of self-understanding, you know, and anything can be a doorway. I mean, my mother, she would never pick a freaking lane. I used to tell her, pick a lane, Ma. You'd call her as a kid, right? We were raised Roman Catholic, okay? I found out at 30, my mother had been a Baptist. I had no idea. I was like, what the hell am I going to find out at 40, you know? So she said, oh, your father was a Roman Catholic. So we did it, you know, it was that generation or that thing. So I said to her, but in calling my mother as a child, you know, I would call her on the phone and I'd say, Mom, listen, I got a quick question for you. She'd say, oh, honey, I'm here with the nuns. I got to go. The nuns? What nuns? Oh, they're lovely nuns. I'll call you later. Mom's hanging out with nuns. Okay, I'd call her another time, you know. She'd be like, honey, I'm here with the Quakers. The Quaker? What are you doing at a Quaker meeting? Honey, they're lovely people, very friendly people. You know, I'll bring you over here sometime. Bye-bye. I'd call her another time. I'm here with the rabbi. Mom, you're with a rabbi. I thought we're not even Jewish. You never know, honey. I'll call you later. I'm talking on like this. You know, her best friend was a Buddhist monk. We called him Chatty the Monk because they were always on the phone for just hours. And so my mom taught me. I used to think she couldn't pick a lane. I literally would say, Ma, pick a freaking lane. But I think people generally have like two highways they choose. They choose this kind of go long with one thing and find everything in that. Or they like to have some of everything and they find the one in everything. And so my mother and I did opposite. You know, I did the go long with one thing and one tradition. And my mother, you know, she loved all traditions, and it wasn't that she couldn't pick a lane. I came to realize she had picked a lane, and it was the lane of universality in all things and connectivity. And I thought, damn, I missed that. But I'm so glad I caught it before she, this was during the last year of her life, and she was quite sick. And I was so glad. I asked her as many questions as I could during that year. Anyway, that was one of them, and explored it together. And so when we look at this verse in the Gita, again, it's like a little recipe, right? Yat karoshi, it says, whatever you do, yat karoshi. And yadashnasi, and whatever you eat, or eat can have the metaphor of take in. And yajuhoshi, whatever you offer. And I'm going to come back to that in a second. And dadasi yat, whatever you give. So we know about giving, but we have to study through wisdom traditions offering. And I like that the verse delineates the two. Yat tapasyasi Kaunteya, the verse says, so Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, whatever you go through tapas around, whatever you suffer. And he says, here is the royal secret. Tat gurushva mad arpanam. And I'm going to talk about this in the workshop that I'm giving at Big this weekend. But he says, make that an offering to me. And it's not me, some better God, it's whatever the me is in this text means the divine in oneself. This is a yogic interpretation. And when we make that an offering, how do we do that? How do we make all of this an offering? And so it asks the question, the verse asks the question, how do we make my actions, what I take in, what I suffer, what I give, what I offer, how do I make all that an offering to the divine? But I mean, at least it gives you like a little cue card, recipe card of, you know, this is the recipe. Make all of this an offering to me and you will enter into the center and the heart of the tradition. Mm-hmm. And so our job then is to kind of solve for X or solve the koan, if you will, to borrow the Buddhist, you know, the words of like sit with that question and go, how do I make all of this an offering? And then you go out in your life and somebody pisses you off, you flip them the bird and you're like, wait a minute, is that making an offering? No, I don't think I want to do that. Or you see a family member and you have lunch with them and you say, is this making an offering? Or you walk down the street and you see your neighbor and you wave and you feel love in your heart. And is this an offering? But you have to start somewhere. So start with the stuff of your life. And that's why the verse gives us all these different five verbs, you know, karoshi, ashnasi, juhoshi, dadasi, and tapasyasi. If we can find the channels of our lives and make them into an offering to the divine, well, that's going to be one hell of a great practice. And so that's one of the ways, one recipe of this concept of what an inner warrior does. And it's so, it's like this cosmic weapon that no one knows you have, you know, that you don't even realize you have until you know you got it. Because you're like, how do I make this? What is making an offering mean in this context? And then how can I try to get into this pose? And so the Gita offers us these beautiful recipes. And like you were saying before, with will or with, you know, how do I work with myself in such a way? And that's one of the things I love about that text. And I think that that's what yogic texts overall do. They give us really cosmic recipes to, you know, I feel like we're all Houdini in a box and yogic teachings give us the way to unlock and, you know, voila, we're out of the box again. So that's just a little something in terms of, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, because I did want to talk a little bit about it, and that's just an example. So let me chant the verse, and then we can sort of do our wrap up or whatever, but I'm going to chant it.
Yeah, sounds good, yeah.
Okay, Gandhi, you ready? He's like, yeah, whatever. Yat karoshi yadashnasi yad juhoshi dadasi yat yat tapasyasi Kaunteya tat kurushva madarparnam Tat Guru Shvamadare Parnam. So this is fun stuff, you know. What is yoga? The tradition, the traditions. This is all. This is like Play-Doh, you know, of adult life. You know, once we get ourselves to a place where we can start looking at the purpose and meaning of life. Some kids even do it now, but it's not as common. More commonly done among adults. You know, then we can grow ourselves into yogic maturity. You know, we can become adults, but maturity is about applying wisdom to our lives. And yoga offers us, and many wisdom traditions, but yoga, I can speak for yoga and Sanskrit, they offer us a lot of opportunity to that effect. Oops, Andy's moving around here. So yeah, so thank you guys so much for having me on your beautiful show. It's been just a delight to have this cosmic chin wag together, our cosmic dialogue. And what did you want me to say? What I'm doing this weekend or in general?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, you're good. I was just going to say, tell our listeners where they can find you, where they can learn more about, or, you know, find out where they can take. Maybe they're interested in taking classes and see where you're teaching and what you're teaching and what's available.
Okay, sure. So you can go to the website, sanskritstudies.org. S-A-N-S-K-R-I-T, studies.org. And there you can find out, you can see the website and all that. Some things that people might like to do Well, we have a lot of teleclasses. I've been doing this educational teleclass thing for like 9 years, and it's been amazing to watch it blossom. And so you can go there and find out what's happening on things like the yoga of sound or Sanskrit training. That's all available there. And then we have online Luminous Soul Satsangs, where those are, you know, twice a month. There's one at 6:30 to 8 New York time and one at 1 to 2:30 New York time. And you can check out the dates on that. That's under the Satsang tab. And so those are some of the ways that people can stay in touch. And I would love to connect with you all. And I'm going to be at Big Yoga this weekend.
Yeah. So if you live in Houston, this weekend, Manorma is flying in from New York and doing a weekend long workshop on, it's called The Warrior Within, through the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah. So highly, 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 highly recommend you do that. It's very special that Manorma is coming in to Texas for that. So if you want to sign up for that, you can just contact us, like me and Maria on the show. Mm-hmm. You could also go to bigpoweryoga.com, go to the workshops tab, and we'll make sure you get signed up. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys, for having me on your beautiful show.
Thank you.
I want to have like tea and biscuits and sit with you guys for another 2 hours and wax on about the cosmic nature of life. I've just so enjoyed being with you both, and I look forward to seeing you in person this weekend.
Yes, you'll probably see Maria too. I think she's going to come help out. So yeah, we are forever your students. We'll see you this weekend. Listeners, you know, go follow Manorma on social media as well. And have a wonderful day, everybody. Yes. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. Thank you, Manorma. Thank you, Janan. Thank you, Edgar. Thank you, Mario. Thank you, Gandhi.
Thank you, Gandalf.
Gandalf. Yes.
All right, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Ciao, everybody.
BYO Blanket is a production of The Light Generation.
The BYO Blanket jingle was composed and produced by Studio Sassafras Music in Houston, Texas.
And the vocals are by Jessica Zoller. Thanks for listening.
Blanket Ninjas.